introverted noise.
Hurry up, Daddy.
All right, all right, all right. We're back. Got the whole crew here. It is another episode of the Pocket Protectors Podcast. I am your host, Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason. And we're going to jump right into it. We got a lot of good stuff to talk about. Doctor, new background. How you doing?
Doing well, man. Settling into Cincinnati. Enjoying my time. Just working on football all day. Can't complain much.
You know, and I mean, you're being a little modest right now, but you know, I feel like I saw you someplace, maybe on my television screen. You know, it's probably my phone screen where I saw it the first time. But, you know, they got you out there looking good for the camera, talking about smart stuff.
Yeah, man, it's pretty fun. I can't believe I allowed myself to look at the comments section, though.
Yeah, you were in there mixing it up. how many push-ups did you do before you went live?
People don't know this, but the founder of PFF, Neil Hornsby, has a gym in his basement that would make like Lifetime Fitness blush. Let's just put it that way. So I've been lifting weights, you know, relatively frequently to try to make sure that I can hang around with some of these people here.
All right, Luke, and how many weights have you been lifting lately?
Two.
Good, 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 good. How are things, man? What you been up to?
Doing good, doing good. I got confirmed I'm going to be at training camp for, I think, like 10 of the days, including the night practice. So I'll be on the sidelines rubbing elbows with the strip guys and everything. It'll be awesome. So I've been just like prepping for that and working on my 90-man series, which is almost done releasing.
We need more David Morgan. More David, all the David Morgan.
Can only write so much about the best tight end on the Vikings.
That's when right. David Morgan becomes Wesley Walls, we're all going to pretend we are the first ones.
All right. We got some stuff to talk about, and some of it's going to be things we talked about kind of in passing or a little bit before, but it keeps coming up, and people keep making different arguments about it. So I felt like we should dedicate a bit of time to talking about, you know, Stefon Diggs, because he is currently, you know, the Vikings player in the news. He's the player that most expect to get a deal done with next. But detractors continue to kind of pop up here and there and cite his volume stats for as reasons why he shouldn't get paid. And so, Eric, start with you here. But I also know Luke has done some things in terms of some player comparisons. But how good is Stefon Diggs? And I guess when you guys are evaluating wide receivers, what are the things that you're looking at PFF to help us understand, you know, who's good and who isn't good?
Yeah, I mean, so the volume stats thing is a pretty big misnomer, just because, like, if you think about the Vikings throughout Stefon Diggs' time, it has not been conducive to him getting a ton of targets. The 2015 team, for one, he was inactive for the first three games, you know, not because he was hurt or anything, but just because he was, you know, they viewed him as too young to have played at the beginning. And then that team was a very much a ground and pound, three tight ends, blah, you know, all that kind of stuff. Nothing that really has anything to do with Diggs. 2016, he, you know, he had some injuries, but at the same time, the Vikings were also like ahead early in the season. He had the injuries in the middle of the season, and then their offensive line was such that he couldn't get the necessary targets. And then last season, the Vikings were very much like running away from teams from like week 10 on. And then when they needed him in the game against New Orleans, the game against Philadelphia, he averaged 100 yards a game. So he's terrific. Doesn't drop a lot of passes. He's only dropped 11 passes in 3 years. He was the most efficient wide receiver on contested plays a season ago, And that's something, again, where you have to add a little context. Case Keenum had a good year, but in many ways he's putting up balls that are contested, and Diggs is taking those from being incomplete to being complete. As far as his value, this is up on the – when we projected the NFC North on ProFootballFocus.com. Stephon Diggs over the last three seasons has been the most valuable non-quarterback in terms of wins above replacement in the entire division. So
I'm sorry. Would you be able to say that again? Because I'm not sure I heard you clearly there when you said – I'm sorry. What did you say? Just repeat what you said so that, you know, make sure – people understand.
So people talk about Thielen, right? And like how he is a relatively proven commodity, but we forget that when in Teddy's last start in the 2015 playoffs, Adam Thielen played exactly two snaps, you know? So like Thielen's great and love him. But in fact, like Stephon Diggs is actually more of a track record than Thielen, A, and that track record includes being the most valuable non-quarterback in the NFC North since 2015. So take that for what you will. He grades extremely well in our system. He doesn't do too many negative things. With balls in the air, he makes a lot of plays.
Boy, all right. I like that. Well, Luke, I'm going to bring you in here. I think we've established Stephon Diggs is good at football. But, Luke, I was interested in your take because he's been compared now to a couple different players. And when we're going volume stats, Jarvis Landry, who's a player who kind of reset the market a bit there at wide receiver, his name comes up. Brandon Cooks is obviously the most recent player to get paid. His name comes up. I even saw Demaryius Thomas today. Someone telling me that they'd rather have Demaryius Thomas than Stephon Diggs, which, whew, that's, oh, whew. Yeah. Not, yeah. Anyway, so Luke, I know that you've been looking at this a little bit here, kind of, you know, comparing how Diggs matches up with some of these other receivers. And I'm interested in your take on, you know, yeah, how he does in your view stack up against some of these guys that he's being compared to and, you know, who are currently being paid considerably more than him.
Yeah, I found it really interesting because everybody kind of started debating, you know, Cooks versus Diggs as soon as Cooks signed that big extension, because now they're in the same category, right? They're going to sign extensions like within a week of each other. So I just wanted to look at that comparison. And basically, during 2015 and 2016, they were like the same player. They were both excellent, really efficient. In terms of yards per route run, they were both really similar. In terms of wide receiver rating, Cooks was a little better. And then Cooks, I don't want to say fell apart because he still had a 1,000-yard season and he still like was fairly efficient and had a whole bunch of explosive plays. But he kind of had a down year, and Diggs had the best year of either of their careers. In terms of PFF grades, all three of Diggs' seasons are better than all four of Cooks' seasons. And in terms of yards per route run, Diggs ran away. In terms of rating when targeted, Diggs ran away in 2017. So I think if you want to talk about like volume stats, and I get why people are like so obsessed with them, they're what we always see, they're what we know, they're what we understand. But, you know, all the stuff that you brought up, Eric, you know, sometimes there were three tight end sets. Sometimes you're running because you're ahead. And you have to account for that, right? You can't downgrade Diggs because he didn't catch a ball on a running play. That makes no sense. So that's what yards per route run is like meant for, right? Okay, mm-hmm. Take away all the snaps where it wasn't a passing play. Now how do they do efficiency wise? And that's why it's stable. It's because that's a very good idea and a good thing to adjust away without like adjusting too much away. And from that angle, Diggs is a better better wide receiver than the guy who just made $80 million. But I would also caution that Cooks' contract only had like a quarter of it guaranteed. And I would imagine Diggs gets more guarantees and that will probably bring the overall number down. And they can also use certain incentives that can bring the cap number down because both 1,000-yard season incentives and play all 16-game incentives would be considered not likely to be earned under the current cap rules, which means they wouldn't count against the cap. And that space would probably roll over.
One of the things I think to consider with Brandon Cooks, and you have to be really careful when you're evaluating wide receivers. And so, for example, this to me, I think the better comparisons to be making for, you know, if you're trying to compare Diggs to receivers is somebody like Michael Thomas of New Orleans, right? So Michael Thomas is, you know, one of the more valuable receivers in the NFL a season ago, but he has, much like Cooks had, Drew Brees throwing him the football, right? Cooks is so far in his career had Brees, Brady, and now Jared Goff, whereas Diggs has had Bridgewater with Turner, Bradford with Turner, Shermer, and Keenum with Shermer. Like, we, those contexts matter. And what we have found at PFF is if you adjust, as Luke said, yards per route run, even quarterback rating on targets, extremely stable stats for receivers. If you adjust for quarterback performance, a lot of that goes away. And so, you know, in some sense, like, you have to be careful. When you look at Diggs, the reason I think a lot of us are buying into him is he has been great even with suspect quarterback play. And I think even for those of us who are bearish on Case Keenum, or not Case Keenum, on Kirk Cousins, we're still, like, we don't think necessarily that Cousins is going to bottom out bad enough for guys like Diggs and Thielen not to be good. So, whereas with Cooks, you know, Cooks is very good at some things that are unstable. Deep passes, for example, he's second in the NFL. But that's one of our more unstable stats. So a lot of Cooks, you know, 60% of Cooks' receiving yards last year came on balls that were more than 20 yards in the air. Like, you flip that even a little bit and he becomes a 750. He becomes Sammy Watkins from a season ago, which, you know, may or may not be worth that money.
Yeah, with Cousins, I know that, like, with the QB annual charting, the accuracy charting that PFF released in, what, like, February or March?
Yeah.
With Cousins, most of his passes were, I think it was, like, the frame on the frame designation, where it's not, like, a perfectly thrown ball, but one that is, like, on their body, catchable. Maybe they have to adjust to it, but mm-hmm. a decent wide receiver should be able to haul that in. And a lot of Cousins' passes fell into that kind of, like, second category that still counts as accurate but isn't perfect. And having two guys like Diggs and Thielen means that you can convert most of those into receptions. So the designation between accurate plus and just accurate becomes a lot less important when you have a wide receiver that can basically erase those inaccuracies.
Mm-hmm. And Luke, you mentioned yards per route run. Is that the most, I guess, stable predictive metric that we have for wide receivers?
As far as I understand, unless you have something else I don't know about, Eric.
Quarterback rating when targeted, if you take that wholesale, is actually a little bit more stable. But that's often because quarterback play is most stable. So if you adjust for quarterback play, then some of those underlying metrics, Pro Football Focus grades for one, are in that category as well. And then yards per route run, very much as Luke said, because it adds context. If you're not on the field all the time, you know, some teams rotate their receivers, for example, or your team runs the ball more than other teams, it adds in a better efficiency metric for you, basically.
Awesome. All right. Well, we've got that out of the way. I feel like, you know, we're not going to belabor the point too much. Everyone here is in agreement. Stephon Diggs needs to get this money. There's another player who, not necessarily Viking specific, but it's kind of rehashed some of the old debates, the debates that came up during, you know, draft time around Saquon Barkley. Really, they come up every year when, you know, the new once a generation talent comes up in the draft. That's a running back, and how valuable are they? How much should we pay them? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, Le'Veon Bell is the latest. He's still only 26 years old. You know, in his prime, been a workhorse back. You know, absorbs a ton of touches both in the running game and the pass game, and he would like to be paid essentially like a top 10 wide receiver. Is really the range that he's looking for in terms of, you know, commitment as you move forward. So the franchise tag is paying him, I think, $14.5 million, which is, you know, a considerable amount of money. That's wide receiver money, but obviously he wants, you know, that commitment over the long term, that guaranteed money. And so, you know, generally we are on the don't pay running back side of things around here. But with a player who is as good as Le'Veon Bell, Eric, is he someone we should make an exception for because he is so clearly an elite talent?
Yeah, so George and I wrote this on ProFootballFocus.com this morning, and then we had it on the forecast as well, which came out today. And the idea is that, so we know that running the ball is a negative proposition from the perspective of EPA, and running the ball to Bell is no different. Another thing to consider is the fact that his Pro Football Focus grade on a per rush attempt basis has gone down every year since 2015. His yards per carry went down by almost a full yard last year. So as a runner, the trends are not moving in the right direction. Receiving the ball, the age curve for running backs is actually, you know, relatively flat. So guys can stay good receivers, as we found, whether it be yards per route run, those kinds of things. But is that enough to, like, consider a player like Bell differently than other running backs? And we came to the conclusion that no, it's not. Because when you look at Bell and running backs in general, throwing the ball to a running back is worth like one third of throwing the ball to other positions. And even if a running back's out in the slot, it's about one half. So even if you split him out, when Bell goes into the slot, he does not become Jarvis Landry. He just becomes Le'Veon Bell in the slot. And so those are things that, like, we look at that and you're saying, okay, well, we make, you know, Bell's exceptional at what he does, but what he does is simply not that valuable, even if it's different than what a lot of players with his position designation do. When it comes to, like, things like wins above replacement, he's about a third as valuable as Antonio Brown on his team and about a sixth as valuable as Ben Roethlisberger. So if you're thinking about who to make happy on that team, Bell is probably not one of those players. And then kind of lastly, the icing on the cake is that the slot receiver is already on the Pittsburgh Steelers. Juju Smith-Schuster led, you know, I believe it's yards per route run from the slot or among all players a season ago by a mile. So he's already good enough there. When Bell was injured in 2015, D'Angelo Williams almost put up 1,000 yards. He had 11 rushing touchdowns. So, like, it's just a fundamentally replaceable position no matter who the back is. And so it's weird that Bell turned the offer down, to be quite honest. And it's also weird that the Steelers made such an offer, although the guaranteed money makes it seem as though the deal wasn't as player-friendly as we first looked at it.
And is there any value? So one of the things that that you know, someone said, kind of as we were discussing it a bit on Twitter, was that one of the arguments, I guess, that Bell made was that, you know, the volume of touches that he absorbs in and of itself is valuable, that he touches the ball more than anyone other than the quarterback, and as such should be paid, as maybe not as much as the quarterback, but maybe more than some other player who isn't touching the ball as frequently. Is there a value in that, you know, he is able to absorb that high amount of touches in a given season?
How much do you want to pay for 2.5 yard plays?
Well, that's it. That's exactly it, right? So, like, you're talking about, so the my favorite anecdote in this, and as, like, I went to the Kansas City Chiefs playoff game against the Steelers 2 years ago, and the Chiefs were 100% content to run six defensive backs out there and allow Bell to rush for 170 yards at five and a half yards a clip. And the reason was that, well, for one, it got more difficult to run in the red zone. But for two, when they allowed Ben Roethlisberger to drop back and throw, they were gaining more than 5.5 yards a pass, right? And so in my estimation, having a running back like that almost goads you into doing less efficient things. And so, like, the fact that this guy's like, well, I tempt Pittsburgh to do inefficient things more often, and then I can absorb that, I don't know necessarily if that works in his favor. Now, again, he's great. He's a great running back. And if all you could do in football was run the ball, he'd be one of the most valuable players in the league, right? But there are simply other options, and there are cheaper options, right? So, like, in the third round, you could get that. I mean, last season, the two best running backs in the rookie class were drafted in the third round. And, you know, and those guys are getting paid relatively nothing. D'Angelo Williams, when he came to Pittsburgh after sort of washing out of Carolina, was relatively weakly paid. You know what I'm saying? So for all of those reasons, I don't necessarily see it as – I don't see that as a great argument in Bell's favor.
And I guess the last question about Le'Veon Bell is, I guess it's the other side of the argument that he's making in terms of the touches – is you already mentioned that his efficiency as a runner is, you know, trending in the wrong direction. Have you guys looked at anything at PFF in terms of how, you know, the workload and volume that a player like Bell has already, you know, put on his body, the miles that he's already put on his body thus far? how that does affect kind of future performance? And is that something that potentially could be viewed as a negative in these negotiations in terms of, you know, all the touches that he's already had to absorb as a running back thus far in his career?
Yeah, not explicitly, but we have done age curves to sort of validate what other people have found for running backs. And they're 100% on the mark in terms of, you know, running backs do peak at a certain age. Weirdly, it's more on the volume side. So they get the most volume in the beginning of the career. From a yards per carry perspective, it's actually monotonically declining with their age. So like they're the most efficient when they're young, and then they sort of like fall off a little bit as they get more volume and they get, you know, more tread on the tire. I will say this, it's not as prevalent in football because you can cut players and the guaranteed money is not as substantial. But I do think it's important. And baseball, hockey, all these sports, the bad teams do this. You should never pay somebody for what they've done. You should always pay them for what you think they'll do. And what we've discussed two players tonight, and I think that they embody this perfectly. Everybody's saying that the Vikings should not reward Stephon Diggs for not ever having a 1,000-yard season. And Le'Veon Bell should be getting paid for what he's done for Pittsburgh. And, of course, that's not great money management. I think the three of us are saying Stephon Diggs should be getting paid like an upper echelon receiver because he is an upper echelon receiver. And even though the stats haven't shown it yet, we're projecting him there because all of the right characteristics are set in stone for him. Bell has done all this stuff that's good for the Steelers from the perspective of traditional stats and all that kind of stuff. But if we pay, you know, if Pittsburgh pays for what he's done, I think they're going to be a little bit disappointed for what's going to come.
Yeah, that makes sense. That does make some sense here. All right. So those are the two main topics. We have a couple other things here that we need to get through kind of quickly. The next two, because I'm going to bundle them up together here, Eric, and, you know, putting you back on the spot because you work for the organization that, as Vikings fans, we love to hate, and we just need to understand why Pro Football Focus hates our big guys so much. So in the last couple weeks, or maybe it's all been in the same week, I don't know, it's all a blur, it's all kind of blending together here, but first you come out and say that we have the 28th ranked offensive line in the NFL. So that was first. So we'll go there first, and Luke will walk us through some of that and help me understand what's going on there. But then the next thing, you had the audacity to rank us at 9th in terms of defensive line when we have Everson Griffin, we added Richardson, we got Linval, we got Danielle Hunter, and you put us at 9th. Why does Pro Football Focus hate the Vikings? Eric?
That's a good question. So this is what I'll say. The Vikings improved drastically as an offensive line in 2017 from where they were in 2016 from an output perspective. Case Keenum was not sacked as much as Sam Bradford was. He was not their offense moved the ball better. Their leading back still had less than 4 yards a carry, but you know, they move the ball better. Let's look at some things, though. So Keenum was under pressure a season ago 39.3% of the time. If I'm looking at all the 29 quarterbacks that all have, you know, the certain dropback threshold, that's behind only Russell Wilson and Jacoby Brissett. Now, why aren't we seeing some of the issues there? Well, we're not seeing some of the issues there because Russell Wilson, while leading the league in touchdown passes, had a 69.0 quarterback rating when pressured. Jacoby Brissett, 61.1. DeShone Kizer, who's right below Keenum in pressures taken, 32.8. Keenum's at 78.5. Now, we know, we've talked about this, that's an unstable stat. Keenum's probably on the higher end of the variance there. Some of the other guys may be on the lower or median part of the variance. So when pressure happened to Minnesota in 2017, it was not at – we as fans didn't notice it in real time, but it was happening. Here's the other thing. Keenum took a sack on just 10% of his pressure dropbacks, 10.7. That was second best in the NFL just ahead of Phillip Rivers, who had 8.1. And Phillip Rivers, like, was on a huge streak that got him there. Keenum was first most of the season. So even when Keenum was pressured, he didn't take sacks very often. So a lot of those are sort of in place, you know, that make us, I think differently about the quarterback situation. A little bit of context, Bradford took a sack on 19% of his, so twice as many times that he was pressured, Bradford took sacks in 2016. So to me, that's the offensive line discussion. They didn't run the ball quite as well, I think, as people thought. You know, they were better on like fourth and one and all those like tragic plays that Asiata was running in 2016. But ultimately, there are some underlying things that I think are troublesome. They lose Joe Berger. That also is not a trivial thing to come back from. I think along the defensive line, there's a lot of really talented pass rushers in the NFL. I think the Vikings paid Danielle Hunter, and I'm pretty bullish on him. Joseph's great, not the, you know, more of a run stuffer, but a pretty good pass rusher for his spot. Richardson's good as well. Griffin, I think that we're starting to project Griffin a little bit in terms of age. And then there's a huge question of who the heck are their backups, right? Most of the really good defensive line and lines in the NFL, you have players that can kind of cycle in and out. I think that's a big question for Minnesota. And while I don't necessarily know if I'd rank them ninth, I do think that it's defensible.
Okay. All right. Luke.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on the propaganda that Eric just shared?
So I looked into it because I actually read Ted Glover's Daily Norseman piece on that line article, and he was like, there's no way that three of our linemen are worse than Matt Khalil. That kind of makes sense. So I wanted to look into it and just see, like, is there any reason to, like, project different grades next year than we would project this year? And the O-line grades are really stable, so unless there's, like, a reason to, I wouldn't. Like, I would project Nick Easton to have pretty much the same year. In terms of Riley Reiff, he had four seasons leading up to 2017 that he was in, like, the 70s in terms of grade, and then he had a down year in 2017. And I believe he was playing hurt for a lot of his worst games. So I would imagine that that can bounce back if he can stay healthy. And in terms of Elfline, I looked really deep into Elfline's grades and his production and stuff. And in terms of pressures, he trended up pretty heavily as the year went on. He gave up 26 pressures, which is really bad for a center. 14 of them came in the first 6 weeks, including a complete meltdown in the home Packers game, the one where Aaron Rodgers got hurt. Elfline melted down in that game. He was awful. But from the rest of the season on, he really started to clean it up. And I actually think his game by grade, off the top of my head, his game by game grades kind of reflect that as well. So for a rookie to like have a tough start to his rookie season and then trend up, like a lot of rookies have tough rookie seasons and then kind of pull it together. And then their sophomore season is a much better indicator of who they are. So I think that's reason to believe that there's a chance that both Reiff and Elfline outdo them their 2017 seasons grades wise. But on the other hand, the Remmers moving into guard might cause a drop for him, and Hill is a drop off from Berger, considering he's the only guy who we're actually like swapping out. So I think that if I were to predict it, I would probably predict the line to rank about the same in terms of PFF grades as they did in 2017, around 22nd or 23rd. But I definitely get why Mike Renner projected them downward, because, yeah, you got rid of Berger and you replaced him with Rashad Hill. Rashad Hill is worse than Berger.
And he plays a more valuable position, so.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, the last couple things for us to do here. We got a couple questions from Twitter.com, and they're both for Eric. Sorry, Luke. And we talked about a little bit with some of the QB clustering stuff on the last show, but Miles Gorham had a question about, you know, QB clustering. We were talking about, you know, Kirk Cousins and taking sacks and, you know, Case Keenum avoiding pressure and things like that. And Miles was curious if, you know, the QB clustering kind of accounts for that sort of thing in terms of how a quarterback plays, avoiding pressure, things like that, the guys who run more and all of those sorts of things, and how we could project those things forward as we kind of think about, you know, Kirk Cousins playing with the line that we have and the analysis that you know, Eric and team have likely done looking at these sort of things. So, yeah, Eric, I guess, what have you learned from QB clustering that we can kind of project forward as it pertains to Kirk Cousins and pressure avoidance and things of that sort?
Yeah, so in our grades are things like how a guy handles pressure. So certainly the fact that Keenum isn't taking as many sacks, for example, when he's under pressure is going to be reflected positively in our grades. The fact that he's not, you know, like if a quarterback runs into his own sacks, that's going to be negatively graded, those kinds of things. So the fact that, you know, if Cousins in the fourth cluster, that's meaning that like some of that is taken into consideration. His lack of pocket presence at times is in there. But at the same time, like pressure rates, you know, some of those things are not attributable to the quarterback. So if you know, Trent Williams goes out and, you know, that's not something necessarily Cousins has control over. So if you give him a better environment, he might, you know, not necessarily have to be as poor in the pocket and things like that. So, you know, you can learn, certainly the stuff that we grade on a dropback per dropback basis goes into that clustering. And, you know, seeing a guy like Cousins in the same cluster as a guy like Bortles is troubling. That being said, we've seen Cousins in clusters with players like Aaron Rodgers at times. And so it just, I think what to me that, you know, the biggest thing to learn from that, and if you're a Vikings fan, I think it depends upon how you view the supporting cast, but it can be good news, is that, you know, you can possibly see, you know, Cousins kind of elevating himself to the upper clusters in subsequent seasons with the Vikings, provided everything goes well.
I like that. I like that. And then the last thing here, Kirk Cousins, more of it, you know. And Eric, where does the narrative that Kirk Cousins is bad in the red zone come from when his stats look okay?
Yeah, I think the issue with stats is that you have to provide, you know, they have to provide context, right? So if you are, you know, putting up 4,000 yards, 25 touchdowns, et cetera, that has, you have to ask questions like, well, how does he do in the red zone? How does he do? And, you know, some of these things, the answers are unstable, but how does he do in the red zone? How does he do when the playoff, you know, position is on the line? How does he do, you know, what are his sack rates? Those aren't in his quarterback rating, for example. How many of those sacks are attributable to him? I think those are the places to look. And, you know, for me, I would say, you know, if you're looking at trying to project him this season, I think he's probably going to have similar stats than what he had in Washington. The question just always becomes to me is, what does that mean for the sake of the Vikings? Does that mean, you know, is he putting up these numbers while when they're ahead to extend leads, or is he putting them up, you know, to come back from being, you know, far behind, those kinds of things? I don't know. And that's why I'm, you know, very curious to see how he does.
All right. Well, that was it. That's everything I wrote down. We made it, gentlemen. You know, Eric, you plug some of your stuff, but I'm gonna need you to do it again just in case folks weren't paying attention there. You guys have been really, really busy here with the forecast, pumping out articles over at Pro Football Focus. What are the things that you've produced here lately that the people should be looking for?
Yeah, so you know, we have the PFF forecast that comes out every week. We're going to start doing two a week during the season. We have the NFC South. We previewed them last week. We're going to have an article kind of with our win projections going out there. We like, honestly, a Super Bowl future that's anything above 20-1 for New Orleans or Atlanta is very good. We like Carolina's under. And then, yeah, there are a series of YouTube. So I did three win total projections on YouTube for us last week. I'm going to do a preview of the Houston Texans season tomorrow. We have the Le'Veon Bell article that came out today. So a lot of fun, you know, great to be able to talk football with you guys and say that I'm working. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that is outstanding. Luke, you've also been a pretty busy man here. Before you get into plugging, you know, this great work that you're doing on all of the players on the roster, whose story has been the most interesting so far that you found?
Ooh, that's a really tough one because there are a lot of really, really interesting ones. But I think I'm going to go with Trey Matthews. He's a safety from Auburn. and he started his career in Georgia for the Bulldogs, where he grew up. It was like a hometown team, total dream. And then he had some trouble with his grades. He got in trouble for trying to double cash some of his scholarship checks. It was like a whole theft scandal. He had double shoulder surgeries. He couldn't even lay down and be comfortable. He was in like this deep depression, ended up getting kicked off the team, transfers to Auburn. And from there, he basically grinds his way back through more injuries. And by his senior season, he is a superstar for the 2017 Tigers. And he brings that all the way back to the SEC championship, where he's basically playing his now the Georgia Bulldogs that had spurned him in the SEC championship. And we know how that ended up. The Bulldogs crushed Auburn, and that was how his college career ended. So now he gets a chance to kind of have redemption. And unfortunately for him, he kind of enters a safety group that's pretty full. They only really have room for four. And unless he can outplay Curser Harris, which isn't an unclearable bar, but it is worse than what some of the other players are dealing with, especially the linebackers. He'll probably have to either deal with being on the practice squad or have to, you know, hope that he puts good enough preseason tape out there to catch the eye of another team.
When you write the movie of his story, though, he's going to need to win in that that SEC championship game. Yeah, you need him to win that game. But yeah, what have you been working on, man? And where can we find all of the great stuff that you're doing, Luke?
Yeah, so I've been doing this 90-man series. The goal is to cover every man on the 90-man. It started out with just linking to pieces from some of the starters because it's more about, you know, the lower players, the guys in the depth, the camp bodies, getting to know those guys. I'm just about done releasing it on Purple PTSD. They're also releasing on VikingsTerritory.com. I have just the defensive backs, which is going up tomorrow, which will probably be today if you're listening to this. And then the running backs will go up on Saturday, and then on Monday I'm going to post the like kickers and punters and stuff, and as well as a final roster prediction, and that'll be it for that.
All right. Busy. I'm guessing this will be the piece where you tell us Trey Waynes is almost as good as Xavier Rhodes. No?
If no. You want to, yeah. I can whip that up.
Well, all right. Like I said, we made it, gentlemen. As always, it is a pleasure. Eric, I know you're still adjusting to the East Coast time, so thank you for staying up late with Luke and I. Luke, I guess go enjoy the rest of your evening, and listen, thanks for sticking with us here. It's been a lot of fun, and yeah, we'll talk to you guys soon. Have a good one.